720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks so much for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday with me. I hope you are getting outside a little bit today. It is certainly surprisingly warm for February, so we will keep you posted on the weather. But in the meantime, hope you go outside with maybe without a coat. What the heck, right? Well, lots to do today on the program, as ever. Lots to fit into the next hour. And a little bit later in the show, we're going to be talking about a really interesting story that's come up around Michael Jackson's estate. It's a $1 billion estate, and the IRS is trying to recoup about $700 million that's all tangled up in there. So we're going to be making sense of that, because there's some tax and estate law questions to wrestle with there that are really quite interesting. And also, we're going to be talking about some restaurants to take note of, new restaurants in particular, kind of the best of. We're going to be looking to our friends at Crane's Chicago for all that good stuff. But before we do that, there's a story that's been happening this week. You know, there are many stories, and the new administration in the White House certainly moves quickly with those stories. And it seems like once we've caught up on one, another one is unfolding. But nonetheless, with every business, there are ethics and regulations that we all must abide by, certainly in this business that I'm in. But I think all of us have some sort of ethics code to abide by. But nonetheless, there is one attached to many government employees about endorsements. And a White House advisor, Kellyanne Conway, she stepped in it a little bit this week with a comment about Ivanka's line being dropped from Nordstrom. And a lot of people have been talking about that. Nordstrom has been very big on social media from both sides. People supporting the Trump administration, people not supporting the Trump administration. A lot of people have been talking about this. But one person who has been following the story very, very closely is Julie Bykowitz, who is a White House reporter for Associated Press, who joins us now by phone. Hi, Julie. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, I'm sure you're keeping yourself quite busy right now as the White House reporter for AP, because it seems like every time we look up, there are really large twists and turns coming from the new administration. But this story in particular is very interesting, because I feel like a lot of people, at least on social media and anecdotally, were expressing some degree of surprise that they didn't realize quite the ramifications of what Kellyanne Conway said when she said very casually in an interview, "Oh, I'm going to give a free commercial here. Everybody, go buy Ivanka's stuff."
Yeah, and I think that's reflective of possibly how Kellyanne Conway sees things too. Now, this whole issue started actually with the president himself on Wednesday, if you can think back to that. When Donald Trump tweeted and then retweeted from his presidential account his displeasure with Nordstrom having dropped his daughter's fashion line. Really unusual for a president to name a company like that and sort of, put a target on a specific company. And then the next morning, Kellyanne Conway was sort of asked about this issue in an interview with Fox News, where she was actually in the White House giving the interview, and said, exactly what you just said, I like her stuff. I'm going to give her a free commercial here, go buy her stuff. Now, the difference is the president is not subject to the same conflict of interest and ethical rules and regulations that his or her employees are. That's a really interesting sort of dynamic with the White House, any White House, not just this one, is that the top dog doesn't have to follow the same rules as everyone else. So, you can really sort of see things from her point of view, why should she think that she's done anything wrong here? But especially because the president had kind of essentially done the same thing a day earlier. But as I said, she is subject to rules that he is not.
And I think what's also very interesting and complicating about this is that as the House Oversight Committee and the Office for Government Ethics has been talking about this and considering this and hearing from constituents on the matter, it's ultimately up to the president to enforce this and to discipline, any employee who would commit an infraction of an ethical nature.
That's right. It's really interesting, because even though federal employees are subject to a greater degree of rules about ethics and conflicts of interest than the president is, particularly for Kellyanne Conway, who reports only to the president. She really only has one boss in the White House. And so it would be up to the president to discipline her if he felt that she had done, if she felt he felt that she had violated the rules. Now, it's pretty clear, it's very black and white, that an employee cannot make an endorsement like that. So there's not a ton of debate over the fact that she did, in fact, break the rules here. But other than the White House press secretary, Sean Spicer, saying that Ms. Conway had been, quote, counseled on the matter, there really hasn't been any other sort of indication that President Trump is going to punish her in any way. And that's despite the fact that the Republicans on the House Oversight Committee have joined with the Democrats on the House Oversight Committee to, you know, ask for more to be done about the matter. It's just, it all sort of ultimately ends up back with President Trump.
Mm-hmm. And that's what's, I think, perhaps a bit frustrating to people following that story, is that it really, it's not a matter of necessarily calling representatives and sharing your beliefs and urging them to act in a certain way, because it really keeps falling back to Trump. But it's interesting also because it's been a little bit of a rough week for Kellyanne Conway, because we have this, but then also earlier in the week, and again, this all, everything moves so fast, it seems like, with this administration in particular. But just earlier, she had where she said she misspoke, and she said Bowling Green massacre, and everybody immediately jumped on, of course, the word massacre. And she later said, "Oh, I misspoke. That's not what I meant to say. I meant to say something else." But you know, it seems like it seems like her and Sean Spicer in particular are under a lot of scrutiny and a lot of pressure. And so it just seems like every week I say this, but it seems like, well, it's going to be a really interesting week. We have to wait and see. But yet we keep saying this. So I think we need to settle into a place where we're saying, okay, this is a marathon, not a sprint, and looking at all of this and how quickly things move with this administration.
Sure. And, you know, an important thing to keep in mind is that, you know, this is President Trump's White House, and no matter how much people may get outraged or feel disbelief over what individual staff members are saying and doing, you know, he sort of sets the tone in the White House, and it's his call to make on a lot of these issues. That's why, you know, we sort of in the American public are paying a lot of attention to Sean Spicer. And, you know, we may have certain views and opinions of how he's doing at his job, but really the only person watching him who matters is President Trump. And he takes a great interest in how Sean Spicer is performing his job. So, you know, he really, even though millions of people are watching him every day, he really only in some ways has an audience of one, and that's President Trump.
Right, right. Well, there is a third group, though, that you mention in your piece, and everybody, you can go to apnews.com and find this and all the details in it. But there is that third group, the Project on Government Oversight, who has urged Attorney General Jeff Sessions to open an investigation into this ethics violation. Do we think that's going to occur, or do we? Is that another thing that again just would return back to the president?
I think ultimately it all sort of does return back to the president and the priorities that he is setting and the things that, you know, to him are the most sort of important to keep track of and follow up on. And there's no, again, there's just really no indication at this point that he really wants to pursue this. In fact, what we had heard was that after Sean Spicer made the comment that Kellyanne Conway had been counseled, the president was actually rather upset with that terminology. He felt that it made it seem, you know, that she had done something childish or that she was a child and needed to be reprimanded. And he does not see it that way. And so since he's the one who would be sort of enforcing things here, I think that sort of people can take a clue from that the matter is probably over in his eyes.
Well, very, very interesting. And we certainly appreciate all the work that you're doing, keeping us updated on all the things, all things White House. Thank you so much, Julie Bykowitz, for being with us today.
Oh, thank you. No problem. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great Saturday. All right. We're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to keep this conversation going a little bit later in the program. We're going to be taking a look at Michael Jackson's estate. Really interesting pieces to consider there around tax and estate law. Very, very interesting, especially with an estate that big, a $1 billion estate. So more to come on that here in just a bit on 720 WGN. Esteemed producer Griffin Filipich. Nice call with that song. Well, it is that time of year, I suppose, where all the stores are filled with pink and red things and commercial expectations of a holiday are quite high. Lots of things, lots of Valentine-y things rolling around out there if that's your bag to celebrate the day. It is a big business day. There's a lot to it. It's a big bucks day. A lot of numbers we have been sitting here looking at around, you know, cards and flowers and money dumped into the economy on this upcoming holiday. Griffin, you said you found like an infographic. What is that looking like?
Well, basically, if you had to guess, how much money?
Oh my God.
Do people spend in this country on Valentine's Day?
Too much. I think it's ridiculous. I hate, and I'm not saying that. Like, I don't mean to be like a Grinch about it, but I'm just like, if you need a day with very high expectations attached to it, you might be doing it wrong is how I feel about it. But I don't know, millions and millions of dollars, I'm sure, like now, as a Valentine's total, like total money put into the economy around the holiday.
This just doesn't seem possible, but I'm reading from entrepreneur.com. They did this last year, so these numbers are from a year ago, but $18 billion.
No.
$18.9 billion
with a B?
And that gives the average consumer spending upwards of around $142 a person.
On what?
Dinner? I mean, dinner.
Yeah, dinner. Okay.
Something else, a gift. That adds up pretty quick. I don't know. I guess it just shows that either less people are skipping it, as you seem to be interested in doing.
I have skipped it for a number of years.
And some people, I'm just trying to do like the math of like how many people skip it and then how many people just go crazy spending like $1,000.
Well, I remember last year, maybe the year before, I was in Walgreens on Valentine's Day, kind of later in the evening, just like buying shampoo. And I remember this man
celebrating,
right? Celebrating. And this man was like, it was kind of one of those like, you're a woman, which would you rather receive? And he had like a handful of nail polish and then like some kind of like, I don't know, lip balm and perfume thing. And I was like, dude,
it's too late now. It doesn't matter now.
I'm like, you're in the doghouse either way. If you're bringing your woman nail polish, unless she's really into nail polish and that's really her thing. Like that's, you probably should have thought that one out a little better, sir.
Yeah. And this is 1.7 billion of that. Again, 18 billion. Is spent on candy alone.
1.7 billion is candy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Women buy 85% of the Valentine's Day cards, men buy 73% of the flowers.
Oh, okay.
Women, 14% of women will buy flowers for themselves.
Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong. Hey, why not? Every day.
I do that. I would say I do that almost every week. I like to have flowers in my house. The end. Bye.
And then 53% of women say they would end the relationship if they didn't get anything for Valentine's Day.
Oh, my God. Well, I think if you agree on that, you know what I mean? Like, if you know that about your partner, like, hey, we don't.
Right.
This is not a thing we do. I know couples that do intentionally not Valentine-y things. Like, hey, do you want to go ignore this super capitalist holiday together and do something not Valentine-y and fight the crowds?
Yeah.
And that's cool.
I feel like that number lines up with the amount of people that might not be in great relationships. So like,
also that.
They're just looking for a tipping point and we'll make
they're
it
like,
that.
I'm too lazy to break up with you. I'll just ignore Valentine's Day and you'll break up with me.
That's not a terrible idea, honestly. That's pretty good.
Why am I not a dating coach? I don't know. Griffin, we can make our fortune. Oh my gosh. Good times. Well, $18.9 billion. So spend your money wisely if that is a holiday that you are interested in celebrating, because holy moly, that's a lot of money. Nonetheless, we will be talking about another large sum of money, and that is Michael Jackson's $1 billion estate and the $700 million that is tied up with the IRS. We're going to be talking about that on the other side of news here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Of course, we're playing that song from the Wayback Machine because we have got to talk about Michael Jackson for a minute. Strangely enough, he is in the news right now because his estate is in the news. So the IRS is attempting to recoup about $700 million of the $1 billion estate. And this is a really, I mean, it's a fascinating piece. If you want to go to Bloomberg.com, there's a really fascinating in-depth look at how complicated this is, because it really delves into tax and estate law and some really complicating factors that are really fascinating and really about value and how we value a celebrity and their image and all that. So joining us now to talk about this is Devin Leonard, staff writer at Bloomberg Businessweek. Hi, Devin. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Amy, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining me. So this is a really interesting story because there are really a lot of nuances to it and a lot of complexities. But talk us through this a little bit, and why right now is this coming up about Michael Jackson's estate?
Well, basically, I think what a lot of people don't know is that when Michael Jackson died in 2009, he was broke. He hadn't made any new records for a long time. He hadn't toured. You know, he was just about to do a comeback in London, and then he died. But he owed $500 million, you know, half a billion dollars in debt. So at that moment, and I guess the way state law works is that you value you pay state taxes based on somebody's net worth, right when they die, basically that day. So the estate said, I mean, this guy was worth nothing. You know, they said it was about $7 million, and the IRS came back after the folks at the estate, including a guy, a very sharp lawyer named John Branca, who had represented Michael Jackson when he was alive, after he'd started to do a bunch of deals and record deals and live theater deals and that kind of thing. And the IRS said, hey, wait a minute. You know, now that we're looking back, we think the estate wasn't worth $7 million. We think it was worth $1 billion. So then there are specific things they're wrangling over, the value of certain items. But that's really kind of what the battle's all about, in the bigger picture.
It's really very, very interesting. And again, everyone head to Bloomberg.com and read about this, because it is a good long read that's really kind of fascinating. But his daughter plays a big role in this. And we really haven't heard much about his kids or the ex-wife or any of that since his death. Not so much anyway. But she's of age now. And so I think that's probably a factor here that is pushing this along, because she's been through some things. But now that she's an adult, I'm sure there are provisions in his estate that have provided for his children. And she probably stands to inherit quite a bit of money.
Well, that's the interesting thing, Amy, is that the three kids, Prince, Paris, and Blanket, they're the beneficiaries, along with Jackson's mother, Catherine Jackson, who was their guardian, when they're younger. And I think Blanket's 14 years old, so he's still a minor. But they've been taken care of all this time. I think they've, gone to private school and they've done well, but they stand to inherit, the estate, which I think at some point certainly will be $1 billion. It's not worth $1 billion yet, because they're literally just paying off the debt on the estate, I guess, in the last couple of months, with a big deal when they sold Jackson's interest in the Beatles songs. But the estate can't settle until it takes care of all these legal issues, these lawsuits and stuff like that. In the meantime, there's personal effects and things that Michael Jackson owned and that the kids would like for sentimental value. And again, it's not the glove or anything like that, but paintings and his clothes and things like that. And they're all stashed in a warehouse while while the estate and the IRS fight it out.
Right. And I think the one thing that's very, very interesting about this is kind of this idea of what your value is as a celebrity and how it's valued. And there's kind of that anecdotal belief, right, that when you die, it's a good career move because suddenly your stock kind of goes to the roof. But I was kind of surprised about how that's being considered and figured out exactly, because there's not really a base, right? And there isn't really someone to compare Michael Jackson to, really. So it is kind of an interesting task.
Well, the estate said that Jackson's name and likeness, and that's I guess it's called the right to publicity. It's the value of using his name on T-shirts or coffee mugs and that kind of thing. Once you start talking about using him in video games, you're not just using his face and his name; you're using his music too. So that's not just pure name and likeness. But the way the estate sees it is that he was. By the time he died, he'd gone through two child molestation investigations. Nothing was ever proven against him. He settled one case, and the other case, he was acquitted, and that was 2005. But they're saying that obviously had a big impact on his value, lowered it. But at the same time, they're saying he never really did a lot of those deals when he was alive. I think the number that they put on it is $50 million. For his whole lifetime, but the IRS is saying, no, wait a minute, we think that's worth more like $500 million. And so just that number alone, goes a long way to explaining why they value his whole estate as $1 billion as opposed to $7 million. But that's been the big sticking point, and that's really what they're battling about in tax court out in Los Angeles, this month. This trial started last week.
Very, very interesting. And how long do we expect this trial will go on? Do we have indications that it will be a lengthy, very, very lengthy one?
Well, I don't know, but I think 2 or 3 weeks. I don't think there's a jury. I think that the judge just decides. But as far as I could tell, last week was just the estate making its case, and the IRS hasn't really come back yet with its case and its experts whether the evidence of how they reached their valuation. So, I think it's going to be fascinating to watch.
Certainly, certainly. And as people are kind of pontificating around it and people are looking at the way it's all unfolding, is there a general sense about a prediction or a speculation about how it's possibly going to go?
Well, I think, and I quote a lawyer, an estate tax lawyer in my story saying, if somebody came to you in 2009 July 25th, 2009, that's the day that Michael Jackson died, and said, hey, you want to buy, Michael Jackson's name and likeness rights for $2,105? So you'd probably say yes. And of course, he was saying, certainly I would. So maybe that number is a little low. But there's a fundamental sort of difference in the way, the two sides are trying to interpret the laws. It's a California law, by the way. For other states don't have name and likeness rights, or not all of them do. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the estate's trying to say, look, it's the value of that day, and we didn't know what was going to happen after that. All these deals were going to happen. That was all up in the air. The IRS is trying to say, hey, it was Michael Jackson. All these you could have foreseen. They keep using the word, this is foreseeable. The record deals, the live stage, the Vegas deal, all these things, were basically just going to happen anyway. So that should have all been factored into the value of his name and likeness, or at least not so much the record deals, but a bunch of other merchandising deals. There's also a big deal with Pepsi.
Yeah.
So it comes down to can you look back and say. Look what happened, and you should have seen this coming, or do you say, no, it's just the value of that day, and whatever was going to happen in the future, that doesn't really matter.
Well, it is a really interesting topic right now, as we saw so many iconic celebrity deaths in the past year, and just this week we're hearing about Prince and his music library being available on Spotify, and so it is really kind of an interesting topic right now that will probably be rather precedent setting with other celebrity estates. So very, very interesting, and we will keep turning to you at Bloomberg for all of this as this unfolds, because it'll be very, very interesting to watch. Devin Leonard, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. Have a great Saturday. All right, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to be taking a look at some of the best new restaurants here in Chicago and some places to go and all that good stuff. So stay tuned for that here on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Still plenty to do on the show today. You know, we call this the business lunch, but indeed that's a thing, right? That is a thing. The business lunch is a real thing. And a lot of times people go, okay, I got to entertain this client. Where should I take them? Where should I go? Where it'll be quiet enough to do business, but I won't look like a schlub. It'll look nice, right? Well, our friends at ChicagoBusiness.com over at Crane's, they have taken care of that for us. There is a wonderful list about the best new restaurants for business lunches. And our friend Graham Meyer, a writer at Crane's Chicago, joins us now by phone. Hi, Graham. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, so tell us about the best new places where people should be having a business lunch, a literal business lunch here in Chicago.
Sure. So a criteria we use for this, I should say, first of all, are places that either opened or started serving lunch during the year 2016. And we do this every year in Crane's. The other reviewer and I basically pick our favorites from the year of reviews that have gone before. So our list for this year, what I mean to say, is begins with Steadfast, which is in the Kimpton Gray Hotel. That is a hotel restaurant, serves three meals a day. Was reviewed by my partner in reviewing, Joanne Trestrail. The second one on our list is Ocean Cut, which is the seafoody sister restaurant to Chicago's Cut Steakhouse.
Yeah, right here, not far from Tribune Tower. Yeah, I know that one. That's
yeah,
a great
that's
one.
True. They have a great prefix menu that Joanne is big on. The third one on our list is Cold Storage, which is below Swift & Sons in the West Loop on Fulton Market at Morgan, close to the Morgan stop in the Green Line.
And I really like how you've labeled these, right? You called Steadfast the star of the financial district, and you called Ocean Cut grown up and polished. So people can kind of, I would recommend, grab this list and keep it handy for reference, because you probably want to take different kinds of clients to different kinds of places. But Cold Storage you called casually chic seafood in the West Loop.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, something I've found doing this for the past year is that there's no simple one cookie cutter solution for a business lunch. And you start thinking about who is right to bring here, or which clients or which interviews or things like that. And it really does differ a lot. It's not as simple as just saying here's a top 10 list.
Definitely. So what about
so the next
culinary magical realism? Tell us about
yes.
that one.
That's Tanta. That's a Peruvian restaurant that's in River North, and they have served dinner for quite some time. And the chef there is internationally recognized, based in Peru, and this is his local branch. And they just started serving lunch on their roof deck, obviously not this time of year, but last summer is when they started with that. You can have lunch in the regular dining room, but on the roof deck is where it really excels.
And they also own, there's a bar, I think, about two doors down that's kind of a later night but nice kind of spot that I believe is the same ownership as Tanta.
I believe that that's right about the ownership group. It's not the same chef, if I recall correctly, and I'm sorry, I can't bring that to mind right now. But I believe that that's right. The ownership group that has Tanta also has a bar.
And they have a cocktail with absinthe, mezcal, and it's served in a pineapple. That's all I know. That's all I
remember.
That's
all you need to know.
Indeed. Okay, so tell us about the one you have called Gentle Surprise.
Sure, that's Royster, which is owned by the Alinea Group. And every time you'll hear somebody talk about it, they'll mention that it's owned by the Alinea Group, which owns Alinea and Next and the Aviary. All three of those places, Alinea, Next, and the Aviary, are places that you spend a lot of money and have a once-in-a-lifetime kind of experience. And Royster is a more everyday kind of place. And in fact, if you walked in there not knowing it was owned by the Alinea Group, you would probably not associate it with that kind of dining. They have really excellent Southern inflected food. They're very famous for fried chicken they serve at dinner, which you can get in sandwich form at lunchtime. They have a few other things that maybe point a little bit toward Alinea, like a foie gras candy bar, which is fabulous to have for dessert. But you can go in there just anytime. You're not going to spend $500 like you would at Alinea. They're open for lunch every day of the week. And they had, when I was there, they had openings for walk-ins.
Oh, great. Great. Okay. And then also on the list, you have Bad Hunter.
Yes. Bad Hunter, which is a creative name, which sometimes needs explanation if people haven't heard of it. The concept is that a bad hunter would usually come home empty-handed and eat a lot of vegetables. So it's a vegetable-centric menu, although they don't have no meat at all. It's sort of the reverse of Royster, actually. They're sort of lying in wait with very creative and unusual food, the sort of food that you might get on a tasting menu, but in full-size portions and without that price tag that you would get on the tasting menu. But something that I really noticed there was the desserts were very savory in some cases, as you would often find on a tasting menu, and very creative and unusual.
Right. I'm seeing this list. A red curry squash tart. That sounds delicious.
It was amazingly savory. It was almost not sweet at all. It mm-hmm. was, if they had served it, you know, as an appetizer, it would have worked, but it was on the dessert menu.
Interesting. Well, my theory on things like that is like if it's that, you know, it couldn't be that bad because it's on the menu, right? So anytime I find something kind of weird like that, I'm like, well, I'm going to try it because it can't be that bad. It's on the menu. It made the cut. Okay.
Yeah,
and then what else is on the list for business lunches here in Chicago?
We have the Dearborn, which is in the Block 37 building, although it has its own entrance off the street. And that is owned by Amy and Clota Lawless. Their brother, Billy Jr., is the one you often see around at the Gage in Oconto. And the food, that's a very large place, and it has a very wide-ranging menu. My recommendation for eating there is try the things that sound a little bit more unusual. There is an onion grilled cheese sandwich, onion panini or panino. I can't remember whether they call it panini or panino on the menu, but it is basically an onion sandwich, and it's awesome. It's sort of like a French dip with it has a juice on the side that you can dip the sandwich in. It has a small amount of cheese and a lot of onions, and it's like no other sandwich I've had.
Well, better a business lunch than a date, I suppose, if you're dealing with an onion sandwich.
Yeah. You might want to tuck your napkin in on your shirt on that one if you have the appropriate partner of lunching there with you.
Right, right. And then what about the Revival Food Hall?
That is a great place in the Loop that has 15 different counters where you can order takeout. This is not the place to have a business lunch where you need to sit down for a long time and hash out a lot of things in quiet. It's pretty loud there. But if you're going to do something where you're going to get food and bring it back to a conference room, you basically cannot go wrong at any of the 15 counters there. Most of the counters are places that have other locations, bricks and mortar locations in Chicago. Smoke Barbecue, for example, Antique Taco, Furious Spoon, which is a ramen place, and the Budlong fried chicken place, which has another one that just opened in Lincoln Park and is about to open one in Lincoln Square. For a while, they were the exception. They only had the Revival Food Hall place. But basically everything you can get there is a place that has a lot of culinary cred.
Sounds like it, for sure. And then you have another one on the list that I thought was really interesting. It's not really Loop. It's on West Diversity, kind of closer to the Kennedy, and that is Arbor. Tell us about that place.
Sure. We did pull out a couple that are away from downtown. We try to focus our coverage on places that are close enough that people who are working downtown wouldn't have to spend a lot of time doing it. But Arbor, I really would like to highlight. I loved both of my meals that I had there, which is on Diversity near the Kennedy in a building called the Green Exchange, which is an incubator for environmentally conscious businesses. And Arbor has its a counter also. They serve breakfast and lunch, and they serve a fancy reservations-only dinner three times a week. And a huge number of the ingredients they have there are grown on their rooftop or in little plots next to the metro tracks. And they use honey from bees that they keep on the roof. They do a lot of canning and preserving in their kitchen back there. And it's a very short menu, but basically everything we had there was magical. I had a cauliflower sandwich there. I never would order a cauliflower sandwich if I weren't doing it for work. It sounds like it's not going to be good. And I will say it is the best cauliflower sandwich I've ever had. I feel like it's also the only cauliflower sandwich I've ever had, but I feel like anyone that I have after this will be downhill from there.
Interesting. I don't think I've ever seen a cauliflower sandwich. And then you picked one in Barrington, too, that I think it's important because not everybody's going to come into the city for a business lunch, of course.
Yes, that's Epicure Bistro. My partner in reviewing, Joanne, went out there, and it is classic French bistro cuisine, steak frites and crepes and things like that. She highlighted their pâté and their escargot and their cobia as things that she especially loved when she was there.
Lovely. Well, next year when you guys are making this list, you know, if you need a second opinion, I'm here to help you. I'm here to help. Uh-huh. It sounds like you had a lot of very delicious lunches.
We did. We love doing this job. People say that it's the best job in the world. And I'll tell you, the only job that's better is the person who goes along with it and just has to share their opinions and not do any of the writing.
That's right. Just eat and be happy.
That's right.
That sounds pretty good. Well, also head to chicagobusiness.com for this list and a cool list about the best things that you ate and drank in 2016. That is a wonderful list because that tells you, place by place, order this, drink this, do this. And that's a really handy one to keep in mind. Well, thank you so much, Graham Meyer, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You have enlightened us and made us very, very hungry. So thank you so much. All right. Until next time. All right. We're going to take a little break and get you to news and all that good stuff here on the Wintrust Business Lunch coming up on 720 WGN.